The Murthy law firm has been clarifying US immigration laws and procedures for foreign nationals since 1994. We are happy to offer this free service. Please listen to copyright information and restrictions at the end of this recording.
Welcome. Thank you for joining us for today's discussion on other non-immigrant visa options. I am Sheila Murthy, President and CEO of the Murthy Law Firm, and I'm honored and delighted to welcome you for our discussion today. Joining me on today's panel are two of my esteemed colleagues at the Murthy Law Firm, Chris Drynan, who's been practicing for, I'm going to say, maybe 25 years. Myself, I don't have to tell you, I'm probably coming close to half a century, not quite there yet, but been practicing immigration law for a very long time. And of course, Maggie Wagner, who's actually an attorney for a few years with us, but before that she was a brilliant, smart paralegal doing a lot of the non-immigrant visa stuff that she's still continuing to do to help and impact lives. So today's discussion, as we said, is about other options other than the H-1B, because as most of you know, we just had the lottery, the registration and the lottery at the end of March of 2024. And now we're going to talk about what are the other options if you haven't been selected in the lottery and you're like, what do I do now? Now, if you still have your F1 OPT, great. And we're going to touch upon F1 OPT. We're going to touch upon L1. We're going to touch upon other types of non-immigrant options for you as a worker. Well, the first one that I think most of us don't realize or think of is what is called as the H-1B cap exempt employment. So in addition to the regular employers who are subject to the cap or the quota, you also have employers like institutions of higher education, nonprofit entities which are related to or affiliated with an institution of higher education, a nonprofit research organization, or a government research organization. So if it's any of these four, then you can either work at that place or for that place. It could be either for or at in order to be considered cap exempt. And just to clarify, for the institution to be an institution of higher education to qualify as cap exempt H-1B, it must meet certain other criteria. For example, Section 101A of the Higher Education Act points out that the institution of higher education must be considered either a public or a nonprofit institution. And we have seen so many requests for evidence for H-1s where they say it's neither public nor nonprofit or nonprofit. So it's a problem. It should provide admission to students who have earned a secondary education. And third, it must be licensed by the proper institution, the federal agency or whatever, or the state or the federal or combination to provide education beyond secondary school. And fourth, other educational programs which award bachelor's degree or at a minimum a two-year associate's degree. So that's a quick introduction. I'm going to invite Chris to talk about what is a related or affiliated nonprofit entity. Chris?
Thank you, Sheila. That's a question that does come up frequently in this context when we're talking about cap exemption and cap exempt entities. Related or affiliated nonprofit entity has been defined in a couple of different ways for our purposes here. And this relates both to the cap exemption issue and to the acquia fee that some H-1B employers have to pay on top of the normal fees. This definition can be a situation where the nonprofit is connected or associated with the college or university through shared ownership or control by the same board. In other words, you have a board of directors of the university that also controls the nonprofit institution. Or you can have a situation where the nonprofit is directly operated by an institution of higher education. Or you can have a situation where the nonprofit is attached to the institution of higher education as a member branch cooperative or a subsidiary. Or you can also finally have a situation where the nonprofit has entered into a formal written affiliation agreement with the institution of higher education that establishes some sort of formal working relationship between the two entities. and it has to contribute, the fundamental activity of the nonprofit has to directly contribute to the research or education mission of that university as well. That's probably one of the more common ones, the situation where you have an affiliation agreement. For example, between a teaching hospital and a university. That's one of the more common ones you'll see in daily practice. Now, another thing that's important to remember here is you can take advantage of this CAP exemption even if you're not directly employed by the CAP exempt institution. You can have a situation where you're working for some other entity that would not be CAP exempt, but if you're performing the majority of your duties at the CAP-exempt institution, and your job duties are directly related to what the CAP-exempt institution does, you basically get to take advantage of this exemption, even if your direct employer would not be CAP-exempt. For example, you could be a physician working for a for-profit physicians group, but you're working at a teaching hospital that would be CAP-exempt. You're a doctor, you're primarily doing duties that are directly related to what that hospital does. So in that case, you could take advantage of that CAP exemption. Now it's on the burden is always on the person on the company or institution that's filing the H-1B to prove this. And USCIS can be very demanding about the documents to demonstrate this, but it can be done if you have a situation like that.
Thank you, Chris. Next, let's jump to the topic of the categories reserved for certain nationalities. So there are several treaty-based non-immigrant classifications for specific to citizens or nationals of countries like Canada, Mexico, Australia, etc., right? Important, of course, it is not restricted to the applicant's country of birth, unlike priority dates that we speak of all the time. Therefore, if a person who was born in India later obtained citizenship, let's say in Australia or Canada or Mexico, et cetera, Singapore, that person would be eligible for the specific visa classification that we will discuss. This is limited to citizens. A permanent resident of the country would not qualify for this classification. And we will further discuss that the citizens of these countries are still required to meet all of the qualifications for this particular visa. And so I'm going to invite you, Maggie, to talk and share a little bit about the TN visa.
Yes, of course. So thank you, Sheila. We're going to start this discussion with the TN visa category, which is only available to our neighbors to the north and south. So this category is based on the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or the U.S.-MCA Treaty, formerly known as NAFTA. So like the name suggests, it is an agreement between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. So one of the fundamental requirements, of course, would be to qualify for a TN is that the person must be a citizen of either Canada or Mexico. The TN category is available for those who will be working in the U.S. in any one of the professional positions that are specified in the regulations. It's an incredibly long list, but some of the notable categories include accountants, doctors, registered nurses, pharmacists, all manners of scientists, university professors, hotel managers, computer systems analysts, lawyers, and engineers, including software engineers. That we work with a lot. So for the vast majority of these professions, the applicant does have to have obtained a college degree in a related field to qualify. Experience alone or even a combination of education and experience generally will not suffice for a TN category.
Thank you, Maggie. And what is one of the exceptions we often talk about? Maybe, Chris, you can talk about the management consultant position.
Yeah, one exception to the degree requirement when we're talking about a TN is management consultant. You can qualify for a TN management consultant based either on a degree or 5 years of relevant experience. Now, the thing to remember about management consultant TNs is they are looked at very closely because it's a category that tends to sometimes be overused a little. When you're a management consultant, you really are supposed to be a consultant, meaning you're not supposed to be a normal employee of the company. You're supposed to be someone extra who's performing some sort of consulting duties. So technically, if you are a direct employee of the company, if you're within the normal hierarchy of the company, that's problematic if you're trying to do one of these management consultant TNs. So that's something to keep in mind. Now, another thing to remember is you can file a petition for TN status within the United States with USCIS. It's possible to do that. Generally, that's not done, but there are situations where you might want to do that. Canadians would normally apply directly at the port of entry because Canadians are visa exempt. Canadians, in almost every circumstance, do not need a visa. Mexican citizens, however, still have to apply for a visa at a U.S. embassy or consulate. You don't have to, although unlike other non-immigrant classifications like H-1B, you don't have to have a petition approved ahead of time. You would merely make an appointment at the embassy or consulate and apply directly with your documentation. You cannot be self-employed on TN, but you can be sponsored by a Canadian company to perform work for a U.S. company. In that situation, the sponsored worker could be the owner of the Canadian company. TN status normally is granted in 3-year increments, and you can extend these indefinitely as long as you continue to qualify for the status. So it's not like an H-1B where you have an inherent limitation to how long you can be in the status. TN can technically be extended forever. And dependents of TN status holders, spouse or minor children, are admitted in TD status, which allows them to live here and to go to school, but they are not allowed to work. That's not part of this classification for the dependents.
Thank you, Chris. I know it's often, there's definitely some concerns or questions often about self-employment, like you said, which is not permitted, but you could potentially be sponsored by the Canadian company. And I think people don't understand or realize that. So there are options for people who are Canadians to consider. Again, speaking to a knowledgeable lawyer, somebody at the Multi Law Firm certainly is an option. Let's jump from the TN now to the E1, E2 treaty trader, treaty investor category. The E1 and E2s are primarily available to foreign national whose country of citizenship has a bilateral treaty with the United States. So these people can enter the United States either to carry on substantial international trade, mainly between the U.S. and the treaty country, or to develop and direct the operations of a U.S. company. And it's not really between the country, but if you own a company. So, for example, the E2 treaty trade, the E2 treaty investor. So what, E1 is treaty trader and E2 is treaty investor. So the E2 treaty investor category requires the individual or the company to have made a substantial investment in the United States entity. The E1 and E2 can also be used for those who are coming to work either in a supervisory, executive, or essential skills position for a qualifying employer. Generally, these classifications work for large, well-established companies, but we have seen that we've also utilized it for smaller businesses and entrepreneurs looking to start build their own startup in the United States. As I said, as we discussed earlier, E1 and E2 is not available for all foreign nationals because the law requires that there must be a specific treaty between that country and the U.S. So only for those people who are citizens of that particular country which has a treaty of friendship, trade, or commerce with the U.S. and that has signed that qualifying treaty could apply for this category, right? And the list of countries that actually have such treaties is very long. It ranges from Japan to Australia and most of the European Union, some less obvious countries such as even Iran, Pakistan, Taiwan, etc. But of course, India does not have a treaty with the U.S. for those who are certain nationalities. Some treaties cover both E1 and E2, while others only cover treaty trader E1 or treaty investor E2 category. And I'm going to invite Chris to talk about, I guess, what is substantial trade And what is the meaning or definition? How does that work, Chris?
Well, the E-1 category is reserved for treaty traders. And to qualify for E-1, you have to engage in substantial the phrase is substantial trade between the treaty country and the United States. Now, substantial is not defined anywhere, but there are some guidelines that are provided. It must be in an amount of trade sufficient to ensure a continuous flow of international trade between the U.S. and the treaty country. So it can't be a sparse or minimal flow of trade to qualify here. Cannot be based on a single transaction. There should be a continuous flow of trade. And the volume of exchange is the primary focus, but monetary value also is important. And a greater and what the regulations say is that greater weight should normally be accorded to cases involving more numerous transactions of larger volume. So it's a little it's tough to pin down to some extent, but there are some guidelines here that the government will look at. Now, another standard here is that more than half of the total amount of the international trade conducted by the business must be between the U.S. and the treaty country. And also the person applying for the E-1 can be either coming on to carry on the substantial trade between the U.S. and the treaty country, or the person can be coming as a key employee of the company, such as an executive, a supervisor, or an employee with essential skills. The E-2 category is reserved for treaty investors. And to qualify, one must make a substantial investment in the U.S. business.
Right. And again, substantial is not really defined, but the officer will, again, look at three specific criteria to determine if it could be considered substantial. The first is that there must be a substantial investment in a proportional sense. So that would mean, you know, substantial in relationship to the total cost of either purchasing an established enterprise or creating the type of enterprise under consideration. The second would be that it would be sufficient to ensure the treaty investor's financial commitment to the successful operation of the enterprise. And the last one is if it's of a magnitude to support the likelihood that the treaty investor will successfully develop and direct the enterprise. And then the person applying for the E-2 can either be an actual investor coming to develop and direct the operations, or like the E-1, it can be an executive, a supervisor, or essential skills employee of a company that has invested in a U.S. business. And for both the E-1 and the E-2, the company sponsoring the E-1 or the E-2 worker must be at least 50% owned by nationals of the treaty country, and the foreign national applicant must be a citizen of that same treaty country. So that's important to keep in mind. And additionally, in the E-1 and E-2, visas are typically issued for up to 5 years. The foreign national will generally be admitted for 2 years at a time, and there's no maximum number of times that the E-1 and E-2 visa can be extended. But unlike the H-1B and L-1s, it's important to remember that this is strictly a non-immigrant visa. So that means that the visa cannot be issued if the individual has an immigrant intent. And then the spouse or children of the principal E-1 or E-2 can be admitted as E-1 or E-2 dependents. Those dependents don't have to be citizens of the treaty country. And dependent spouses are eligible to apply for EADs and work authorization.
Thank you, Maggie. Next, let's jump to the E3. And for those who may remember, E3 visas are available for citizens of Australia who plan to come to the U.S. to perform services in a specialty occupation, which is sounding very similar to the H-1B, right? Which is an occupation that requires theoretical and practical application of specialized knowledge and attainment of the bachelor's degree in a specific specialty or higher for entry into the occupation. The E3 is pretty much, as I said, identical to the process for H-1B employment, including the requirement of completing a labor condition application with the U.S. Department of Labor, the LCA that we talk about. Again, remember, LCA is not the same as labor certification for the green card. This is just the H-1B LCA, which is similar to the E-3 for Australians. It was to get them out of the quota and part of the agreement that was entered into between the United States and Australia. But if the person is outside of the United States, the person is not required to file an I-129 with the USCIS, but an LCA certified by the Department of Labor is required. The beneficiary can actually apply directly at a U.S. consulate for the E-3 visa and enter on the E-3 visa. If the applicant does not have the equivalent of a U.S. bachelor's degree, then the person is eligible, the Australian citizen or national is eligible to combine education and work experience. 10,500 visas are set aside for this particular category each fiscal year, but this number has pretty much never been used. So the demand is less than the supply. Dependent spouses are granted the E3S status, and while dependent children are granted the E3D status. Dependent spouses that have the S are authorized to work incident to status, which is a big plus point or a big reason for people preferring sometimes the E's compared to other categories, right? Again, like what we talked, what we just discussed, like the E1, E2s, the E3s are approved for 2 years at a time and can be renewed indefinitely. So next, let's touch upon the P visa classification for artists, athletes, and entertainers. Chris?
Yes, the P visa classification is another visa classification that you do see fairly frequently. It's not, I wouldn't say it's one of the more common visa classifications, but you do see it. It's for artists, athletes, and entertainers. And there are a couple of varieties here. The P1 classification is reserved for internationally recognized athletes who are coming to the U.S. either as an individual or as a member of a group or a team to perform at a specific athletic performance. You have to have international recognition, but this does not need to be professional. This could be an amateur league or an amateur event, and that's fine. Also, for entertainers who are coming to the U.S. to provide an integral and essential part of a performance as part of an entertainment group. And they have to have been affiliated with that group for at least 1 year. And it also has to be internationally recognized as outstanding. The group, you don't have to, in and of yourself, have individual recognition. We're talking about the group here. Now, the P2 category is for artists or entertainers or for their support personnel who are coming to the U.S. either individually or as a group to perform in what's called a reciprocal exchange program between one or more U.S. and foreign counterpart organizations. I mean, these can be nonprofits or athletic organizations. This is a category you don't see very much because the criteria that make you eligible for this are very, very restrictive. So it's not a classification you see very often at all. There's also the P3 for a non-immigrant artist or entertainer. This is for individuals or groups, and it has to be culturally unique artists or entertainers. And when we're talking about culturally unique, that's defined as a style of artistic expression, methodology, or medium that is unique to a particular country, nation, society, class, ethnicity, religion, tribe, or group of persons. In other words, this has to be something unique. You have a unique skill, unique ability, unique talent that you are bringing to the United States, sort of a culture, to enhance the culture, essentially, is what the idea is. And these activities don't have to be non-commercial. These can be commercial events as well.
Wonderful. Thank you, Chris. A little more information, I guess. We have some information about spouses and families and employers and all of that that maybe Maggie wants to talk about.
Right. So in the P3 category, the petitioner is often the employer, but it can also be a sponsoring organization. The beneficiary is the employee or the entertainer. And even if it's a performance group, all entertainers within that group must be listed as individual beneficiaries using the I-129 attachment form. And the beneficiaries don't have to be performers. They can also be teachers or coaches who are coming to the U.S. to impart knowledge on a culturally unique form of artistic expression. And then those companion classifications is a P3S, and it's for essential support personnel. The employer doesn't need to be in the field of the endeavor. For example, you know, if the purpose of admission is limited to a specific competition, event, or performance, an event can include an entire season or performances. And a group of related activities can also be considered an event.
Great. Thank you, Maggie. Regarding the period of admission for the P1, the P2, and the P3, so for the P1, you get up to 5 years. P1 for teams or groups, and P2 or P3 for artists or entertainers. The period is determined by the USCIS to be necessary in order to complete the competition or event, not to exceed 1 year. And extensions for P1 individual athletes, that's in 5-year increments, up to a maximum of 10 years. And extensions for all others, it's pretty much to complete the event in 1-year increments. There's a grace period of up to 10 days before and 10 days after the end date. And Chris, there's a consultation process.
Yeah, as part of this petition approval process with USCIS, you have to submit what's called a consultation, which is a statement, a letter essentially, from an appropriate labor organization having expertise in the specific field, stating that they have no objection to the individuals coming to the U.S. In P1, P2, or P3 classification. And these are typically labor unions or professional organizations or, these types of organizations that have some expertise in the field. And these consultation letters have to address, for P3 classification, they have to address whether the applicant's skills are culturally unique, whether the events are cultural in nature, and whether the events are appropriate for the P3 classification. For P1 applications, they have to address the applicants or the group's ability and achievements in the field, and whether the applicant or the group is internationally recognized, and whether the services to be performed are appropriate for the P1 classification.
Thank you. Let's jump to the O1 classification for individuals of extraordinary ability or achievement. Maggie?
Right. So the O1A non-immigrant category is reserved for individuals with an extraordinary ability in the sciences, education, business, or athletics, but this does not include the arts, motion pictures, or the television industry. Extraordinary ability in the fields of science, education, business, or athletics means a level of experience indicating that the person is one of the small percentage who has risen to the very top of their field or endeavor. And then two evidentiary bases for showing extraordinary ability is, one, receipt of a major or internationally recognized award, such as the Nobel Prize, and two, as an alternative, an individual can also submit convincing documentation in at least 3 categories, which include membership in associations, which require outstanding achievements for their members, published material in professional or trade publications about the individual, and has commanded or will command a high salary or authorship of scholarly articles in the field.
Oh, thank you, Maggie, for discussing the O1 category. Let's jump a little bit to the O1B for discussing the O1A category. Now we can discuss the O1B, which is for individuals with an extraordinary ability in the arts or extraordinary achievement in motion picture or television industry. So the O1B, similar to what we just described with the O1A, is extraordinary ability in the field of arts, which means distinction. Distinction means a high level of achievement in the field of arts, evidenced by a degree of skill and recognition, substantially above that, which is normally encountered to the extent that the person described as prominent is renowned, leading, or well-known in that particular field of arts. To qualify for the O-1 in the motion picture or television industry, the person must demonstrate extraordinary achievement, and this is evidenced by a degree of skill and recognition significantly above that ordinarily encountered, to the extent that the person is recognized as outstanding, notable, or leading in the motion picture and or television field. Now, O2 individuals are those who will accompany the O1s, providing assistance that is an integral part of the O1A's specific event or performance or essential to the O1B's production. It needs to be noted that the O2 classification is limited to foreign nationals who accompany the O1 principal in the field of arts and athletics. It is not available to individuals accompanying O1 individuals in the field of science, business, or education. What about the written advisory opinion, Chris?
Yes, an O1 petition has to be accompanied by a written advisory opinion or a consultation letter. It's from a peer group or a labor organization, unless you can demonstrate that that group or organization does not exist, in which case USCIS will make their own decision based on the evidence submitted with the application. If you've submitted such a written opinion or a consultation within the last 2 years, you can file for an extension and request a waiver of the consultation requirement by providing a copy of the previously issued letter. Now, it's there. You can typically find a list of these organizations. In some cases, it's a very common process typically in the motion picture industry or the music industry. These are very well known, and these organizations have a very detailed procedure for getting these letters because it's done fairly frequently. Now, the O1 classification can be based on a single or multiple offers of employment, and the petitioner can be an actual employer or can be an agent, which is a common situation for musicians. Usually they'd have an agent. Now, the approval of the initial petition can be valid for up to 3 years, and there are extensions in one-year increments for an unlimited duration. There is no global limit on O1 status. It can keep being extended basically indefinitely.
Wow, that's pretty amazing and impressive. Thank you for that information, Chris. Let's go next to the J-1 visa category. Maggie?
Sure. So the exchange visitor or the J non-immigrant visa category is for individuals approved to participate in work and study-based exchange visitor programs. The purpose of the program is to provide foreign nationals with the opportunity to participate in educational and cultural programs here in the United States and then return home and share their experiences, and to also encourage Americans to participate in educational and cultural programs in other countries. And the J visitor visa program consists of several principal parties. The Department of State, which issues the J visas to exchange visitors and their dependents, designates exchange visitor program sponsors and creates administrators and administers foreign federal regulations and policies governing the exchange visitor program. So the exchange visitor program sponsors, which are legal entities that have applied for and received a designation from the Department of State to conduct an exchange visitor program and have been enrolled in CVIS. The exchange visitor program sponsor either directly offers the program in which the exchange visitor will participate or places the exchange visitor in an appropriate program, depending on the scope of the program sponsor's designation. Responsible officers, or ROs, and alternate responsible officers, AROs, who are individuals who have been appointed by an exchange visitor program sponsor to perform the duties set forth in the regulations and to present the exchange visitor program sponsor. And exchange visitors who are aliens that have been selected by an exchange visitor program sponsor to support in a particular exchange visitor program. And then, of course, the Department of Homeland Security, ICE, and SEVP, which manages CVIS, admit the person to the United States in J exchange visitor status and adjudicate certain immigration benefits for exchange visitors and their dependents. And the CVIS database and the CVIS help desk.
Great. Thank you, Maggie. So as we just talked, you know, the J-1 is a very, very broad. It's very expansive because it has different categories, whether you're a professor and researcher, a scholar, short-term scholar. You could even be a student, a trainee, an intern, a teacher, an au pair, a camp counselor, a government visitor, summer work travel, international visitor, physician, very common J-1 physician, specialist, right? So there are all these. And obviously, in the course of this short seminar, we're not going to be able to go over every single one of these, but many of them aspire to gain professional experience in the U.S. to advance their careers and lifelong opportunities and to be able to use this. They talk about soft diplomacy with J. Many people have traveled to the U.S. to build these bridges and have lifelong relationships. And while many individuals may choose to come to study in F1 or H1B, some greatly benefit from participating in the J1 exchange program as interns or trainees. And so just in because of the time, I think we're just going to kind of jump, touch briefly now. It literally, there's a form and there's a process and all of that. Let's jump briefly, Chris, to the next category, which is the R worker or the religious workers.
Thank you, Sheila. The R visa is for an individual who's coming to the United States temporarily to work as a minister or in what's called a religious vocation or occupation. So a minister is someone who's actually authorized and trained to conduct religious worship and perform other duties performed by clergy of that religion. We also have what's called a religious vocation, which is a formal lifetime commitment through vows, investitures, ceremonies, or other similar indications to a religious way of life. These are things like monks or nuns, would be examples of a religious vocation. And there's also a religious occupation is another part of this category. Now, to qualify as a religious occupation, the duties have to primarily relate to a traditional religious function. So duties that are primarily related to, they have to involve teaching, instilling in others, carrying out the religious creed or beliefs of the denomination. These duties do not include positions which are primarily administrative or supportive in nature, although you can have limited administrative duties that are only incidental to the primary religious functions. That's okay. Religious study or training for religious work does not constitute a religious occupation, but a religious worker may pursue study or training incidentally to this status while they're in the United States as an R1 non-immigrant. To qualify, you have to be a member of this religion for at least 2 years prior to filing the application, and you must be coming to the U.S. to perform a religious job either as a professional or a non-professional capacity. Both can qualify here.
I was going to say, and Maggie, do you want to just wrap it up?
Yes. So as I was saying, just, you know, to keep in mind, coming to the U.S., you need to work at least part-time, so at least 20 hours per week. And the work must primarily be related to traditional religious functions. And R1 cannot be used for the person to primarily perform administrative or supportive functions, such as, you know, clerical employees or fundraisers. And then performing work in support of the religious organization is not the same thing as being a religious worker. For instance, a person providing tech support for a church's online presence generally would not be considered a religious worker. You must be sponsored by a nonprofit religious organization here in the U.S.
Thank you, Maggie. And to wrap it up, the first time a particular religious organization files the R1 petition, the USCIS will not approve the case until the Fraud Detection and National Security, FDNS, performs a site visit. So if the petitioner is filing the R1 for the first time, this tends to greatly increase processing times. Further premium processing for R1 petitions is only available if the site visit has already occurred. R1 status is available up to 5 years. The person would be eligible for another 5 years after residing abroad and being physically present outside the U.S. for a minimum 1 year. R2 status is available to the dependent spouse and children, but there's no employment authorization. So to try and wrap up this particular section is we've got touched upon the TN, we've touched upon the E1, E2, E3, we've touched upon P1, P2, P3, and then we've touched a little bit upon the O1A and O1B. And finally, we've talked about the J1s and the R1s, the religious workers. So with that, on behalf of Chris Drynan, Maggie Wagner, and myself and our entire team at the Murthy Law Firm, we want to thank you for joining us for today's discussion. And we certainly hope that if you're not picked in the H-1B lottery, for you or your employees, you would consider one of these options and use us at the Murthy Law Firm to help guide you through the process. Thank you and have a wonderful rest of the day. Bye-bye.
This is a free service. The content is the protected, copyrighted property of the Murthy Law Firm. Unauthorized recording or dissemination of these materials without prior permission is prohibited by law. Learn about our firm, how to engage our services, and more at www.murthy.com.